This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from the beautiful hill country of Texas. Today's guest, when I first started the show, I made a list of my top 10 dream guests. And today's guest was number one on that list. And that is the one, the only, the great, the New York Times best-selling author, Eric Metaxas. He wrote Martin Luther, If You Can Keep It, Bonhoeffer, Miracles, Amazing Grace. He's written over 30 children's books, and our family, Squanto, is our favorite. But of all of his books, my favorite book is his latest book. And it is truly one of, if not the most charming memoir I have ever read. And so for me, it was just a great privilege to talk to Eric about this wonderful book, Fish Out of Water. And I really just want to get on with the interview. As you'll hear, it's been a rough day for me. We talk about sort of some news I just received minutes ago or minutes before the interview. It's been a rough day. I just want to get to the interview for you. All right. It's a beautiful privilege. So we got to talk about our sponsors. This episode is being brought to you by Movie to Movement. You can download our latest movie, Divided Hearts of America, wherever you download movies. And it is our mission at Movie to Movement to promote a culture of life, love, and beauty through the power of film. You can go to our website, movietomovement.com. We are also being sponsored by the Vulnerable People Project. Stand in solidarity, stand shoulder to shoulder with the most wonderful people in the world as they serve the vulnerable. And you can do that by going to thegreatcampaign.org. If you become a monthly donor, you get a free copy of my book with John Zmirak, The Race to Save Our Century. And as you know, John and Eric, they're good friends. They go way back. We actually talk about John on the show. Now, one thing you need to know about Eric is he is the best salesman, second best after Mike Lindell, of pillows in the world. He is like the biggest sponsored show. And so if you go to the Radio Listener Square to buy your pillows, your sheets, your robes, your mattress topper, you could use the code Eric, but that you shouldn't. He's a fish out of water, but he's a big fish. You should use the code Jones. And here's why you need to go to mypillow.com, because they now have a special. And I just got, this is hot off the presses. Their latest special is on Mike Lindell's slippers. They are designed to be worn indoor and outdoor all day long. They're made with MyPillow foam, impact gel, so they prevent fatigue, and it is made with quality leather suede. It has faux fur, not real fur. Okay, so if you don't have to worry about environmental activists throwing red paint on your feet. Now, if you're from Hawaii, we are the biggest podcast in Hawaii, I believe. And these aren't our kind slippers. These are, you know, mainland slippers. You can wear them inside and out. They're amazing. They're comfortable, and they're good for the whole family. And you can get them by going to mypillow.com and using the code Jones or Eric. Use the code Jones. And now for our interview with the great Eric Metaxas. Eric Metaxas, welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
My privilege to be on the Jason Jones Show, Jason Jones. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for saying my name six times. Also, if you would use my code Jones when you're doing your MyPillow commercials, that would help my family out quite a bit.
That's what I say. I say to people, if I can just leave you with one thing to remember in this sermon, in this talk, it is when you go to MyPillow.com, use the code Eric. All right, we'll get the jokes up, you know, out of the way up front. It really is good to be with you. Thank you for inviting me on this.
No, Eric, you know, I just texted you right before I called you to do the interview, and I've been crying for a half hour, and I had to scrub my face, and I'm trying to kind of talk through a smile. But my good friend, Dr. Nahum Ghaffari, Dr. Nahum, died of COVID on Good Friday, and I just found out. And she was the bravest woman I've ever known. She allowed herself to be captured by ISIS to care for the Yazidi. And the reason why I felt I still had to do this interview today with you is because you became a mystery to me on the day you had Shirin and Dr. Ghaffari on your show, because we were supposed to have a segment to talk about the Yazidi when no one in the world knew about the Yazidi. And I know radio, you know, my background's in radio production, and I know you don't do an entire three-hour show on genocide if you want to keep your audience around. But yet, when I suggested during the break that you didn't have to give us the whole show, I think I kind of, you got mad at me. And I asked myself, what is this guy's deal? How is he doing this? This is the most beautiful thing. No one knows about the Yazidi. He's giving us his whole show. But where does this guy come from? And that's why I wanted to have you on my show, because when I read your book, which I didn't read, and I don't think anyone should read, you need to listen to it. You need to get the audio book. It is amazing. It is amazing.
People have been saying that to me. Listen, I love to read my own audiobooks. Whenever I write a book, I try to read the audiobook. But this is my story, as you know already. It's the story of me growing up and, you know, going off to college where I met our mutual friend John Zmirak. And it's all these crazy stories. And I thought, I've got to read the audiobook because I know the characters. I can do their voices and, you know, my father's a Greek accent and stuff. So a couple of people have said that they're really enjoying the audiobook, and I kind of forgot about it. I was like, oh yeah, I recorded that. It took me a week in a studio, but I'm glad people are, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Well, no, I literally, my sister was in Chicago, who's half Greek. And so I appreciated a lot of the, you know, the Greek elements of it. And she had to get to Mississippi. And because it's a big book, I wanted just to have an excuse to listen to it. I'm in Texas. I said to my sister, I'll come pick you up. And I jumped in my car in New Braunfels, Texas. I drove to Chicago with you the entire way. But I have to say, I knew you. I had the answer to my question. Who is Eric Metaxas? The riddle was solved in chapter zero.
Are you serious?
No,
that's funny because, yes, the first chapter is called chapter zero because chapter one is when I'm born. But chapter zero is the story of my parents, families, you know, growing up, each of them growing up, my dad in Greece, my mom in Germany. And then they met in an English class in New York City. And of course, I come out of that union. So I kind of thought chapter zero has to be their story culminating in my birth. So I'm glad you noticed that.
Well, there's more to it than that. I mean, the title is Amphilos, right? I mean, you knew that this was the center of. I mean, you knew this is the center of who you are. That you're, and what I got.
Oh, yeah.
The answer is your thoughtfulness to the sufferings of your parents, your grandparents, and your great grandparents, and beyond, made you thoughtful to the suffering of others, and it's why you use humor. I mean, you're a funny guy. It's a funny book. And that's why if you're not bright, and I'm not that bright, if I was reading it, I think I'd miss a lot of the humor. But, you know, when I'm listening to you, you give us a little clues with your intonations. Okay, he's in irony right now. This is called irony right now.
Actually, you're right. I didn't think about that. But when I was reading it, yeah, you do that with your voice. You let people know this is a joke. That's very kind of you to put it that way. And listen, yeah, my family, both my father and my mother and their families really suffered, you know, and I know what that world is, that you know, what we have in America, we are so spoiled. We don't have any idea how blessed we are. And so when people, you know, like your Yazidi friends are there, I'm in awe of these people. I'm in awe of what they're going through. And I kind of feel like, why do I have a radio program? The least I could do is to use it, you know, to get their story out. So it was my honor. I mean, absolutely my honor. I'm just, I'm thinking, look at what you're doing, Jason Jones. You're taking these people around. You're doing all this stuff. The least I could do is spend a couple hours letting them tell this story. So that was my honor, and I'm so glad I did it. But, you know, I'm also a people person, and, you know, once I got to know you, I'm like, whatever this guy's selling, I'm buying. So this is, it was a joy for me to do that.
Well, what you don't know is after that, we were high-fiving in the green room, and Shirin, who is a survivor of ISIS, just months before we were in your studios, you remember she had been in a camp, an ISIS camp, suffering things I don't even want to say. And but she was smiling, but you know, she didn't want to be seen smiling in pictures. But you know, her entire family, 123 relatives, all of her aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, gone. And, but you gave us such hope. And then we met with the vice president a couple of days later, and it was just, the world had never even, they didn't even know what was happening. They didn't know the Yazidi existed, let alone what was happening to the Yazidi. And you filled that community with such hope. In fact, I was in an Uber several months later, and the Uber driver saw me, and he said my name, Mr. Jones. It's a privilege to have you in my car, and I love your pin. And he had a mohawk. Turned out he was a Yazidi from Erbil who knew me. I said, oh, how do you know my name? Oh, because it's Uber. He goes, no, I found out of your work from the Eric Metaxas show. So,
are you serious?
Yes.
That is terrific.
Yeah.
Man, you never know who's listening.
No.
Praise God.
And so, yeah, when I read this Amphilos, but for people to know, I just want to, the people you meet in this book, your mom and your dad, and you can't judge a book by the cover, but the cover of the book is a hint to how special this book is. And in a way, it reminded me of...
Well, I got to say, by the way, because I don't know if we even said it, the title of the book is Fish Out of Water, and that... I'll explain that later, but it's called Fish Out of Water, A Search for the Meaning of Life. And so it's a story of my life up until Jesus came into my life at age 25, blew my mind, changed everything. So it's a story of my life until that point. And the cover, that's my dad on the cover at the Statue of Liberty. My mother and dad were on a date in 1958. My mother took the picture, and that's my father in the picture. And what could be more appropriate? It's kind of amazing. It's a beautiful picture, and my mother's not like some photographer, but it ends up just being like an amazing photo.
So your mother took that photo on their first date?
Not their first date, but one of their dates, yeah, to the Statue of Liberty. They were married a year later.
So as a filmmaker, I'm going to just tell you, when I read a book, especially a memoir, I put it in three acts. So first act is Fish Out of Water. Second act is the goldfish, glowing fish. You're working for Union Carbide, which I was wondering if that had something. And then I'm thinking, what's the innermost cave? And then in my mind, it's Boston. But I just want to share with some of the characters you meet. You meet the Antichrist, a minor Antichrist. You meet Tata Eleanor, this Greek inventor. I just love when you say his name. You meet your...
Andreas Vlastos, Mr. Vlastos. He was, I mean, there are characters in this book. It sounds like I made them up. It's like a novel.
Nazi painter.
But
there's
these
a Nazi
are real.
Painter. You mean the Nazi painter?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we're not making this up. People, when they read this, I'm just telling you, there's not a syllable that's exaggerated. This is all 100% true. I'm very fastidious about that. When I write my biographies, I'm super careful. I want to get everything right. This was no different. I said, I don't want to stretch a story. It's wrong. You got to tell it exactly as it happened.
Well, and then you meet your uncle, you meet your godmother, and the way you say their names, you remember, I wish I were more literate. I'm like, memory and vocabulary really help you paint a beautiful world. You don't remember this, but when I first met you, it was in 2000 or 99, you were working for Chuck Colson's organization, and it was at... oh my gosh, it was a retreat.
You met me in 1999?
You don't remember it?
Holy cow.
I was a Yahoo from Hawaii who met Senator Santorum, and he invited me to Osprey Point. It was called Osprey Point. And you were there
as
a speaker, and I was just amazed because when I was coming from Hawaii to D.C., I said, I'm going to meet the most brilliant people, and I can assist them in this great campaign of mine to defend the vulnerable from violence. But everyone was so excited. Tony Blankley was there, and Senator Santorum, and his chief of staff, and this whole crew. But they were all excited because Eric Metaxas was coming. I didn't know who Eric Metaxas was, but I didn't. So sorry. And then there was another guy there who did Mars Hill Audio, the tapes or the CDs.
Yeah.
And he gave a talk. Yeah. He gave a talk about how we forgot how to name our world. A tree is a tree. A bush is a bush. We need to learn how to know what kind of tree is that? What kind of bush is that? When I was listening to your audiobook, I thought, a cheek isn't a cheek. Feet aren't feet. Voices aren't voices. With Eric Metaxas, everything is just your memory and then your vocabulary. Your world is just filled with such creativity, such beauty, and such diversity. So I don't know where to begin. Like, who do you want to share with us would you agree?
I mean, I'm honored to hear this from you. First of all, I got to say this, Jason, is that part of me, I wrote this book. It's a love letter to my parents and to, you know, to all the people that are in it that blessed me. I mean, I could cry when I, you know, think about them, but it's a lot of stories. A lot of them are very funny, crazy. Some of them are weird and meaningful and stuff, but what it all adds up to is I wanted to tell the story of my coming to faith, which is at the end of the book. But I said, I want to write a book that you could give to somebody who is not on the same page we are in terms of God. Give it to somebody that wouldn't read a Christian book, because I want to be able to reach those people in a different way. And so that's really why I wrote the book, so that people, you know, who are serious about their faith can give it to people who are not serious about faith as a way in, as a way to reach them and to show them, hey, this is where I'm coming from. I was not always a person of faith. I was not always even, I didn't even know you could know if there's a God. I was so lost. And I thought those people need to hear that we weren't all, you know, we didn't have it figured out. And that's kind of why I wrote it. So I want to say that it's a lot of crazy stories and stuff, but the culmination of it is my conversion, which is totally miraculous. And I said, this is a way to approach people who, you know, they're just not going to read. If you give them a Christian book, they're going to be like, you know, that's not for me. Thank you. But that's not my thing, you know? So that's why I wrote it. But I mean, listen, it's for me, a lot of it is just funny, because some of these stories are just insane stories, as you know, and I didn't make them up. And I said, all my life I've been telling these stories, but it's about time I put them, you know, in between the pages of a book. So, I mean, there's so much weird stuff in here. There was a race riot in Danbury, in my high school, when I was there, when I got there as a sophomore. So there's a race riot, a stinking race riot in my high school. You know, there's a story of an abortion in my 20s before I found God. I was just drifting around, and there's so many weird stories. You mentioned the Antichrist. I mean, that was like insane. I don't want to give that away for people to read it, but yeah, you kind of laugh because you think I was so young and I saw the world differently. But mostly, I laugh at the stuff growing up in the Greek immigrant community.
But he was
because
boring.
My
I love
dad,
how
of
you
course.
Painted, I love how you painted the Antichrist was just boring, and Vlastos was so amazingly interesting. Right? It's just the way you
Isn't
do
that. Funny?
It's poetry.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. In the stream today, Mark Judge reviewed the book and he said some similar things. And I thought, man, these are people, you and Mark Judge, that I just respect a lot. So if you appreciated it from a literary point of view, that means a lot to me, because I am a literary writer. That's my aspiration. But, you know, you never know until people read it what you had. So I'm glad that it affected you that way, because a lot of it is poetic. I mean, it's like there's a lot of sweet stories that, you know, you have to tell them in a poetic way. But some of them are not so sweet. Some of them are just kooky.
Yeah, but it says a lot about you that, you know, I think maybe I'm reading this. And first of all, I thought, this is the first memoir I've read that inspired me. I can write a memoir, because in a way it's about you finding Christ, but it's about everyone you've ever had the privilege of meeting and knowing that's impacted you.
Yes.
It's more about them than
yes.
you. You know, it's about Jesus
yeah.
Christ
yeah.
and your family
yeah.
and the friends and the people who have been kind to you or just weirdos you've bumped into, like the Antichrist.
Yeah.
And so that's what was really striking about it. And it reminded me in a way of a film written and directed by a guy from Queens. Now, they're strikingly different in many ways, but it's Dito Montiel, who is a punk rock guy from Queens, had a film called A Guide to Recognizing Our Saints. And it won Sundance in 2007, and he came from kind of a real broken, violent part of Queens. And he went off to Hollywood and sort of had this guilt of leaving everyone behind him. And he tells the story of all these really beautiful, strange rangers that he left behind him in Queens that he loved. They might be in prison for murder, all these different things. And it's definitely not something, if you're a Christian and you're going to go get the movie, you're going to unsubscribe from this podcast. So I'm not saying you do that. But what it had in it was this gift of admiration. And it convicted me a little bit. Like, I need to remember people better. I need to be more thoughtful.
Well, I mean, it's just one of these things. You do or you don't. It's not like you can make an effort. But these are people that stuck out. And I carry their memories around wherever I go. It's a wild thing, you know. And they did affect me, and they did touch me. And I feel honored, you know, that I get to tell their stories. I mean, Andreas Vlastos, there are characters like that. My godmother, Effie Dragaris and stuff. These are people that I just loved, and I hope I see them in heaven. It just, you know, it really, these are loving portraits. And my grandmother, oh my gosh, she was like the greatest person in my life ever. One of the funniest people I've ever known, a really simple German woman who had an incredible sense of humor. And, you know, when you remember these people, it's there's just something beautiful about it. It really is like people do live on through memory. Like there's something strange about thinking deeply about your memories, and you kind of realize this isn't really gone. It's still present on some level. And I guess it's why we know that we will never die. God created us to be eternal. There's something beyond. And I think that a lot of the stories in this book, they're kind of leaning toward that, even though I didn't know Jesus in the way that I do now. But I feel that I was kind of, I could sense that longing for something beyond this world. And a lot of these people, you know, they were kind of doors or windows to that.
Well, like Les Doss, he deserves to live forever. And thanks to you, he will.
I mean, we have to explain to the audience that okay. When I was growing up, you know, we were always hanging around, you know, in the Greek community, and there was all these kind of crazy Greek characters. And when I was at Yale, I needed a job for the summer. And I kind of thought, oh, I want to be a writer. I need to get a job like in New York City in publishing or something. But, you know, we're working class people. I don't have any connections in New York publishing, right? I can't call somebody up. But I needed a free place to stay. Like, where am I going to stay in New York City? And my godmother, Effie Dragaris, I called her Nuna, because that's what you call the godmother, your godmother in Greek. And she said that she had a friend who maybe he had a place I could stay for, you know, a few weeks or a couple of months or whatever. And she says, she said to my father and mother on the phone, she says, he's bohemian type. He's bohemian, right? Bohemian type. And I kind of thought, cool, bohemian. Yeah, like I want to be a writer. I'm a poet. You know, whatever. I had no idea what I was getting into. And this guy lived in the most, I mean, you got to read the book or listen to the chapter, but it's so bizarre. And he turned out to be just such a sweet soul. And I remember those stories, you know, ever since, and I've been telling those stories. And so the fact that I was able to write a portrait of it, you know, I'm thrilled. What can I say?
Yeah, no, it's the one book I'd say I don't remember giving a book away as a gift as much as this book, since I can't remember. Maybe a Rene Girard's I See Satan Fall Like Lightning, which I give out like a Scientologist gives out Dianetics. That's probably it. And but it is so beautiful, and everyone listening, you have to get it. I mean, can we talk about Boston? Can we talk about what happened in Boston?
Yeah, of course we can. That's why I put it in the book. Okay. Of course, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, this is when I was like in my early 20s. I graduated college. I was totally lost, and I wanted to be a writer. And I moved up to Boston with some friends. Some friends were moving up there, and I was like, okay, great. I'll move to Boston. My literary hero, John Cheever, the writer. He had lived in Boston, so I kind of thought, oh, this is a great idea. So I moved to Boston, and I'd never really had a girlfriend in my life. Like, I was just kind of nerdy. And I, you know, next thing you know, I have this kind of girlfriend. And what do you do if you don't know Jesus? What do you do? Well, of course, you sleep together. And so suddenly I find myself in this relationship. And in no time, she told me she's pregnant. And I remember at the time thinking, like, I was so naive and so young that I didn't even know what to think. And she said, well, I've decided I'm going to take care of it. And I thought, oh, okay, I guess, you know, yeah, this is the woman. You know, I was trained at Yale to, like, you know, respect women, like, you know, this kind of feminist attitude, whatever. And so she says she's going to take care of it. And I go, okay, yeah, great, great, great. And, you know, I look back on it, and I think, wow, like, what a mind-blowing thing that I was a part of something like that. And it humbles me. I mean, I can never judge people who are on the other side of that story, because I lived it. And I know now, I know it's wrong. But at the time, I was just ignorant. I was absolutely ignorant. And I really feel, when I spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast, I made a couple of comments about that, you know, apart from the grace of God, that I'd still be there. You know, I'd be arguing for a woman's right to, you know, to do that. And now, of course, I have a totally different view, but that's the grace of God. So it kind of helps me to understand where people are coming from on the other side, that they know not what they do.
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest fights I've ever been in my film career was you were so kind as to give us an interview for our documentary, and your story, you're sharing that, which I think up to that point was maybe the first time that would have been on film.
Yeah.
And my story were both cut from my own movie.
And wow.
And it was just the director wanted to go in a different direction that was more based on, I guess, race and abortion. But I was so grateful because, you know, like you, I was responsible for an abortion at 17, and it took me, it took me 25 years of fighting abortion. And I literally was praying this, Eric. I said, God, you know, I've been fighting abortion since I was 17, since I didn't even know it was a thing until my girlfriend called me telling me she had an abortion. Why am I fighting abortion? Why am I such a good, strong, brave man fighting abortion and all these other men who are involved in abortion don't? Then it dawned on me right then. It's how she told me. She didn't call me and say, oh, I had an abortion. She called me wailing that her father forced her to get a third trimester abortion. I realized at that minute when I was, you know, God, how come I'm so great and other people aren't as great like me, that it dawned on me that if she would have called me and said, hey, Jay, you know, it's a woman's right to choose and we're both young and I went to Planned Parenthood and got an abortion, I might be a pro-choice advocate.
Yeah.
And so all this time I thought I was had some wonderful natural virtue. It was just by God's grace. Our stories and our experiences can sometimes lead us to truth, but they can sometimes lead us to falsehoods. And it's only by God's grace that we experience this. I know you have a lot of interviews lined up today. To me, you're somebody who's always seemed so comfortable in his own skin. You know, when I first met you at Osprey Point, I don't even know if you remember being at that event. And March Bell, there's some of my
heroes. That's so long ago. Like, I'm really blown away.
Yeah.
I don't think it was as long ago as you're saying, but it was close. I think maybe it was 2003 or 5 or something. It's just a long time ago. I can't even.
It was the Bush administration. Yeah, it was the Bush administration. I remember that because his White House staff was there. But
Yes.
But you always seem so comfortable in your own skin. And, you know, me being a high school dropout from Chicago that then lived in Hawaii and then went to community college and then the University of Hawaii before coming to D.C., I always felt like a fish out of water. And I thought, oh, that's a Yaley. He's a made man. He feels comfortable. I'm the oddball in every room. These people all belong. So in reading your book,
we're faking it, man. We're faking it.
When did you, you know, it seemed to me from the moment I first heard your name that you seemed comfortable in your own skin, standing up to the president on the world stage, for example. And when did you stop and I feeling uncomfortable or feeling like an outsider, or do you still sometimes feel like an outsider?
I think it's totally relative, depends on the situation. And I guess I feel like, first of all, the older you get, the more wisdom you have. There's no doubt about it. So, you know, even when I was speaking from the president, you know, I was in my mid-40s, so it's not like I was a kid. And you kind of get more and more comfortable, I think, as years pass. But also the more you do stuff, the more I did public speaking. I mean, first I was terrified doing public speaking. And then more and more and more and more, you just get more and more comfortable, more and more comfortable. You feel more and more comfortable, you know, joking, being yourself or whatever. And it's just an issue of time. And I think everybody's different. I mean, I look at people that are in their 20s and they look so self-possessed. And I'm thinking, man, I couldn't do anything in my 20s. I was like, you know, afraid of my own shadow. I wouldn't dare speak in front of people or I wouldn't know what to say. So everybody's story is different. But the part of the reason I write the title of the book is Fish Out of Water is because I did feel like a fish out of water. The main experience, the fish out of water experience, is that because my dad is Greek and my mom is German, we'd always hang out in these Greek immigrant communities and I never felt Greek enough. Like it was kind of like, you know, you're in an environment where everybody's Greek. They speak Greek at home. They eat Greek food. My mother's German. So in my house, we spoke English at home. And, you know, my mother, my grandmother, they're German and stuff. So I never felt like I fit in the Greek community enough. I don't mean I didn't fit in at all, but I didn't fit in enough. And I've had that experience many, many times in life where I feel like I just don't fit in the way I would like to fit in. And when I was at Yale, I was the working class kid, you know, from a humble upbringing. And, you know, here you are in an environment with, you know, these are people that grew up on Park Avenue and stuff. And so I think it's kind of a more common thing than we think. A lot of people feel that way, but we're all kind of pretending like, oh, no, not me. I'm fine. You know, I'm fine. But we're insecure. It's kind of the human condition. And I really do believe until Jesus came into my life, I was hopeless. When he comes into your life, now you stand a chance if you know who you are in him. But a lot of people are Christians and they still haven't let him tell them the truth. They're still thinking like, I'm nobody. And Jesus says, I say you're somebody. I say I love you. I say I died for you. And some people think, yeah. You know, they're not ready to receive it. And so to me, becoming a Christian gives us an ability to really see who we are because Jesus tells us who we are. But for me, you know, it's just kind of an ongoing thing, insecurity and sin and fear. It's the human condition. And, you know, we keep turning it over to him over and over and over. And when we see him face to face, you know, we'll know something at that point.
Well, I know what it's like to feel not Greek enough. My mother's third husband, who she'd already had two kids with, she finally moved in with him when I was in junior high. And all the Greek guys would come over to play poker, and they would want me to go.
Now, exactly.
They would want me to go upstairs with the women, all the Greek women, and the kids go upstairs. You know, and I'd walk downstairs in my underwear and the what, you know, but I definitely know.
Well, Greeks have a thing. They're so proud of being Greek that they could make you feel like if you're not Greek, you know, what do you get? What do you have going on? It's a funny thing. I mean, I to me, it cuts both ways. But it's interesting. I think we've all had those experiences. And that's why at the end of the story, when Jesus comes into my life, he becomes the fish out of water. He's the one that puts himself in the uncomfortable place so that we can be with him in heaven. And what does it mean, you know, fish out of water? Fish comes out of the water to die. Jesus leaves heaven to come here to die. And so there's a lot of theological stuff in that. So God, when he speaks in a miracle, it's going to be theologically correct. It's going to be biblical. And, you know, holy cow, the more time passes, the more I realize that that's true.
And you did a good job of emphasizing the point because it may be one of the shortest chapters in the world, history of literature, right? The second to last.
Oh, that's a stupid joke. That is really, I mean, I should say it's just a dumb joke. The most people are not going to get the joke, and I just put it in there just because I had to. But I make fun of the writer William Faulkner throughout the book because when I was studying English at Yale, you know, you read Faulkner, and Faulkner is so pretentious. It's like this modernist, you know, it's like Picasso's art. Like, we're going to do this, you know, cubism. We're going to do this modernist experimental stuff. And everybody kind of doesn't like it. It's kind of like awkward and weird and pretentious and, you know, full of itself. And I remember studying that stuff. And so when I was after college, I was reading Faulkner book during that, when I had that weird train incident, which we won't go into right now, but with the Italian guy on the train, which is just insane. Like, it's an insane story. People, anybody reads that.
I mean, people are going to think you made up a lot of these stories. They're going to be, there's just no way that these stories, but I think these kind of things happen to all of us, but we just aren't paying attention.
Oh yeah.
We're just not paying attention.
Oh no, every word is true. I mean, when people read this book, I'm telling you, every syllable is true. I hate when people make stuff up. I hate it. So this is all true. But anyway, back to the Faulkner thing. So I'm making fun of Faulkner, and there's a Faulkner book. It's called As I Lay Dying. And he does this kind of pretentious modernist thing where one chapter is just one sentence. It's just one sentence. And the sentence is an insane sentence. The sentence is, my mother is a fish. And if you read the book or study it, you'll kind of understand why he did that. But I could not resist the stupid Faulkner joke. And so I have a chapter, and the whole chapter is, my savior is a fish, because Jesus is, you know, the symbol of the fish on the back of cars, which I talk about in the book. In my dream, the golden fish is Jesus. And it makes sense because the Greek word for fish is ichthys. And people don't realize that that's an acronym, which means Jesus Christ, the Son of God, our Savior. The Greek letters that spell ichthys, that spell fish, spell out Jesus Christ, the Son of God, our Savior. So it's all kind of, you know, if you read the book, it'll make sense. But I just had to crack a dumb Faulkner joke.
Well, you know, I think you meant it as a joke, but I thought there was some exemplification in that to the truth. That I took it to mean you wanted us to know that this book is about your faith in Jesus Christ.
Oh no, it is. You're absolutely right. Listen, anybody who knows me, and you know me, I'm serious and joking at the same time a lot of times. Like, it's like I'm saying something real, but I say it kind of with a wink or with a joke. But it is absolutely serious. Absolutely. That's the heart of the book. I mean, that's the punchline. And that's why if you give it to somebody who is not, you know, a Christian, don't tell them the punchline. Don't spoil it. Just say, read this. I think you'll enjoy it. Make sure you read it to the end. And, you know, I hope that they will find, when they get to the Jesus part, I hope it will make sense for them in the same way that it made sense for me, because I didn't see it coming just as the reader won't see it coming. It's just like it happens, and now you got to figure it out.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you just said, because I think that sums you up in my mind. You're serious and funny at the same time.
Yeah.
And when I'm in Iraq or, you know, Syria or Sudan, that's when people are really serious and really funny. People are never more funny than on a battlefield. What do you think is the, because to me that is who Eric Metaxas is, someone who is always serious and always funny.
Isn't it? It's weird, because it's true. I mean, I really do feel like that's just who I am. And these mugs we made up for the Eric Metaxas show, on the other side of the mug, it said, there's a time for joking around and a time to be serious. This is not one of them.
Yeah, that's right. I love it.
It's just like such a dumb statement, but I feel like, I don't know. I guess I feel like joking, usually humor is a kind of truth telling. It's a kind of way to express the irony and the strangeness of life in a way. And that's just who we are as human beings, that we're aware of the strangeness of life. We're aware that we're going to die, but we're not comfortable with death. We're aging, but we're not comfortable with time. You know, we're fish out of water. We don't belong here. We belong with Jesus in heaven. That's where we're supposed to be. And we're sojourning, we're pilgrims here in this strange place. And we make fun of it. We crack jokes because we're all aware that this isn't the way things are supposed to be. We're not supposed to be in a place full of sickness and death and pain and sin. But here we are, and we're trying to figure it out. And so in a way, that's, I think, how a lot of people deal with it. And it's definitely how I deal with it.
And you deal with it publicly as a writer, as a radio talk show host. David Mamet, one of my favorite quotes, he says, writers write for the same reason beavers chew on wood. Their teeth itch. And that resonated with me, because I do what I do because I'm sort of addled by certain things. And is there something that you would say addles you, that's at the heart of the seriousness and at the heart of the humor?
Well, of course, yeah. That's the idea. In other words, that the situation we're in is not a good situation. We're behind enemy lines in a broken world. There's pain and death and sin and sickness and sorrow, and anybody who has the slightest bit of wisdom understands that, you know, and that what do you do about it? Jesus is the answer. But you know, we're here for a season. We don't get to go to be with him quite yet. And so, yeah, that to me is, it's at the heart of it. There's, you know, you're aware of this because you deal with war zones and with persecuted people and stuff. And you realize that's the case wherever you look. There's brokenness and pain everywhere you look, on every face. And, you know, if you know that, you have to long for an answer. You have to say, what's the answer? And I think a lot of people don't know there's an answer, but the answer is Jesus. And, you know, that's hopefully where the book comes out, but that is my life. I mean, I think that there's no doubt about it. That's I walk around with that all the time, and I want to do something about it. And some of that is writing, some of that is you know, my radio, TV stuff. But I do feel like it's not like, hey, let's just have a good time. No, we're here for, God has put us here for a purpose, and I want to fulfill that purpose, you know, with everything that's in me.
Well, I think your book is a dream come true for parents who are like, I have a kid in high school or college, because it's very smart, but it's very accessible. So if, you know, the parent who's like, my kid's in college, they're losing their faith, they're drifting, they're despairing, they're losing their way, I need to get, what book should I give them? This is the perfect book.
I mean, I hope so. I mean, I don't know, but if you think so, I really do. I'm glad you think it's accessible. It is. Some of it is just weird and goofy, but I think it carries itself along. It's not hard, let's put it that way, to read.
Well, I was an atheist, and a dumb kind of atheist until my late 20s. I was a hardcore Ayn Rand objectivist. And there's something you said in there, you're talking about, someone said they're a lay evangelist, and you're like, that's an awkward expression.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It made me, I remember when I first heard it, I'm like, can we use a different word?
And exactly.
So I think that the young person, and that's what it, your memory and your ability to recall, because sometimes we change the narrative as we move along. but it's like your ability to recall how you saw things then. And then you remind me, oh, that's how I saw that too. And I forgot I saw things that way. Or that's when I first was exposed to evangelical Christians or Catholics. Or that's how I saw things.
Yeah.
And
Exactly.
So what's the best way for people to get the book? I mean, we can always go on Amazon or...
Well, they could just come to my house and I could hand it to them, but that's going to be difficult.
Yeah, I've already tweeted out your address. Is there like the Eric Metaxas website?
I'll tell you what, you know what I tell people? I tell people this book, Christian Book Distributors, CBD online, has the cheapest price. You can get signed copies if you go to my website, ericmetaxas.com. In fact, I should tell everybody, please go to ericmetaxas.com and sign up for my newsletter, because I send out the interviews that I do on my radio program. We do these, you know, video interviews. I post them on YouTube and on Rumble and stuff. And I've had some amazing guests. So if you sign up for my newsletter, you'll get them every few days. We'll send that out. But ericmetaxas.com, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, anywhere. If you have a local bookstore, please ask them to carry the book, since they probably aren't carrying the book. But I really think that it's something that I hope a lot of people will read that would not read another book, and that it will lead them to what I found and you found.
No, it was beautiful, and it was fun to listen to, and I will read it. I actually ordered it on Kindle. I ordered the Audible book first, then I got it on Kindle because in preparation for this show, and then I ordered the hard copy just because I wanted it in my library. So I think
You get the pictures, the hardcover, you know, I mean, if you get the actual book, there's a lot of pictures in here of all the characters in the book. And I hate people to miss that. So I'm glad that you get to see the pictures.
Well, even, you know, there's some books you need in the house. There's some books you need in the guest room. And by the way, like all of your books are in my guest room. Like Eric Metaxas books are books you put there. So your godless relatives are like, oh, let me read this. And so this book belongs there.
God bless you, my friend. Thank you.
God bless you, but I just want to thank you, and I don't feel I've ever thanked you properly. Whenever I've asked you to have on a show on a tough topic, you have. I remember I was in the Trump Hotel about a year ago with the Prime Minister in exile of East Turkestan, and there was crimes that were taking place against the Uyghur. I said, well, you know, we know Eric Metaxas. I have to introduce you to Eric Metaxas. Eric Metaxas will most definitely, he lives in New York, but he will most definitely... make time for you. And as we were walking, there you were right there in the lobby of the Trump Hotel. And I introduced you to Sally Hedaya. That was just that to me. I call that the Holy Spirit action plan.
Yes. I remember that. I was thrilled to meet him. I mean, I knew him, you know, from on site, but, well, it's a pleasure, my friend. It's a pleasure to do anything with you anytime. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for not wanting to have John on. As you know, you've made John's Beagles famous, and John's Beagles get to be on my show from time to time. You didn't have any.
John is like such a hero. John's Mirac, man. I just thank God for him. I just realized today, I don't know if he's like 56 years old, but he's like a year or two younger than me, but he is, you understand, no matter how old he is, he's the boy genius.
No, you know, like, for 15 years, he's been like my faculty advisor. You know, writing together.
Well,
he's basically my professor.
Of course. But he's so boyish that I think of him as a boy genius, you know? Like, he's the 11-year-old genius, even though he's in his 50s now. He's just, like, he cracks me up. But anyway.
Well, I think he's the best writer in America, and you give him a platform that he deserves. You know, John is one of those people that made decisions every step of the way that sabotaged his career by doing the right thing, opposing the war in Iraq, and yet I think he is the most interesting, wittiest, best. He's the best writer. I said, if you were writing in the 20s, you know, you should be the editor of the New York Times. But you've given him such a big platform. I started this podcast.
Oh, man, it's my honor. It's why God gave me the platform. And that's why, believe me when I tell you, I'm thrilled to have him on.
Well, I told him I started this podcast just to exploit our relationship even further so I can have him on every 2 weeks. And
terrific.
All right, Eric Metaxas. I know you got a lot of interviews, and I'm gonna hey, can you do me a favor? You know, there's
yeah.
My Pillow has specials this week on slippers. Can you tell stop the that. People?
Oh, slippers,
to,
yes.
They do, no.
Slippers, they Mike Lindell invented, this is not a joke.
Okay.
They are insanely comfortable.
Thank you.
They're almost like shoes that you're going to wear around all the time because they're so comfortable. But go to MyPillow.com and they're there. And most of my books are also available at MyStore.com, which is, you can get there from MyPillow, like up on the right, it says My Store. Most of my books, not this one, but most of them are there. If you use the code ERIC, they're very good prices.
Well, Eric,
very
good prices. My Pillow sponsors this show too. You thought I was giving you some sale. I was trying
to sell. I thought you were joking.
No. They sponsor the show. I wanted you to say use the code Jones.
Oh, that's hilarious. So that's your code Jones?
Jones. You could use the code Eric.
Well, if people are listening to the show, they got to use Jones. Of course they do.
You got
to
use the code Jones, but you could, I don't care. You just got to get the slippers because they're amazing. And
and I'm not kidding. If you go to mystore.com, which is connected to my book, most of my books are there, and you can use the code Jones. Don't use Eric. Use Jones.
We can buy your books on mystore.com?
I've got my books on mystore.com. It's connected to MyPillow. It's the same store, but it's like off to the side. But most of my books are there. Not this one, but most of the others. And I'm going to put all my books up there in a couple of weeks.
Oh, I'm going to... Wait. But is there... if they use my code Jones, do they get a discount on your books?
I'm sure they do. If they don't use Eric, but I'm pretty sure they could use Jones.
Put in Jones.
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
I'm going to promote it every show to go get your book.
Oh, no, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I'm saying, why should people get my book from Amazon if they can get it from mypillow.com or mystore.com? Yeah.
Well, as a marketer, there's one good reason, and that's why I asked you. Sometimes you want to shove your book to be number one in memoirs for the week or something like that. So for the rest of
eternity. Yeah, but since that didn't happen, we've moved on.
Okay.
Well,
it should have, you know, there were two memoirs written in the past 20 years I think everyone should read, and they're very similar. It's My Grandfather's Son by Clarence Thomas and yours.
Oh, and that's high cotton. Thank you, my friend. I better go. I didn't realize what time it was. You are too kind. I'm very grateful to you, my friend. And to be continued, Jason, thank you so much.
Aloha. God bless.
God bless you.
All right, everybody. Eric Metaxas. You know, I get nervous when I got to interview guys like Eric Metaxas because he's one of the best radio talk show hosts in history. And he wrote one of my, this memoir, you have to get. This has been a good year for books for me because we had Carter Sneed with his book, What Does It Mean to Be Human? And brilliant book. Two of the best books I've ever read in my life have been the last two books I've read. What It Means to Be, and I'm a bibliomaniac, guys. I am a bibliomaniac. I read at least an hour a day every day since I was 17 because I was a high school dropout, knew I wasn't that bright, and I wasn't well, I didn't have an education, a proper education or formation. Is if you're a regular listener to the show, you're like, yeah, we got that. But I made it my goal to read at least one book a week as a 17-year-old in the Army. I started laminating books, and I would throw them in my rucksack. Machiavelli's The Prince, Plato's Republic, laminated in my rucksack as a young infantryman, and I have not stopped reading. And in my work day, I have an hour to read and an hour to write every day blocked out because it's part of my job. And I don't want to let those urgent, you know, there's always a crisis. There's always something urgent. And I don't want it to press in on me because I don't want to become thin. I want to increase in depth because of my apostolate to serve the vulnerable. I think I need to plant deep roots to draw from those roots. And so I read a lot. And so what I'm saying is this is a beautiful memoir, and everyone should read it. It's just a joy to read. It is just a joy to read. And then there's the punchline with his conversion at the end. But it's just beautiful. And as we were saying, there is a special at MyPillow.com on slippers. And I'm a slipper guy, as you know, being from Hawaii. Now, by slippers, what we call slippers, you call flip-flops. But these are not flip-flops. These are not Hawaiian-style slippers. These are slippers. But they are the most comfortable slippers in the world. And like Eric said, you're going to wear them everywhere. You're going to be that strange guy wearing the MyPillow robe and the MyPillow slippers out into the yard because the paper boy put the newspaper is like on the street. And you're going to walk out of there with a coffee cup. And your coffee cup's going to have like a gun handle on it. And it's going to say, born in Texas. And you're going to walk out there with the coffee cup, with the gun handle, with your slippers and your MyPillow robe. and your neighbors are going to, you know, they're going to, it's cringy, and you're going to get your paper and come in. That's what you're going to do. You're never going to take these slippers off. Never. And so you go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones or Eric. I just want you to get the slippers. And the show is also being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project, standing in solidarity with the vulnerable, from the child in the womb to the child in the Nuba Mountains. Go to thegreatcampaign.org and become a monthly donor. And, you know, just talking to Eric for a moment until just now, talking to one of my heroes got me so excited that I forgot about the sorrow that we lost Namam Ghaffari, Dr. Namam Ghaffari. And she was truly one of the most brave, she was the bravest human being I've ever met, that would go into ISIS-controlled territory, allowed herself to be captured by ISIS, to care for the victims of ISIS, the young Yazidi women who are being brutalized in ways that you know, but I will not say. And I know her through the work at the Vulnerable People Project. And when I say we stand shoulder to shoulder with the most vulnerable, with the most wonderful people in the world, I was thinking of people like Namam Ghaffari, such a brave and beautiful person. And to think that she died, I believe, of COVID, that's what we're being told, in Syria while caring for the sick as a doctor. She would spend half her year in Sweden working as a doctor, saving her own money, and then taking the money that she saved and friends would give her. Then she would go back to Iraq and Syria to care for the vulnerable. And the last time we were together in Iraq, we were in Erbil. We were having coffee, and I gave her two prayer cards of St. Damien and Mother Marianne Cope. I'll put the picture in the show notes. And I said to her, you're a wonderful, saintly woman, but please don't end up on a prayer card like this. And it struck me when I looked at the picture, she died of COVID caring for the sick. And it just struck me that I gave her two prayer cards, St. Damien, who died of leprosy, caring for those with leprosy, and Mother Marianne Cope, who was a nurse, who served those with leprosy. And that's it. I'm just too broken up to really say more. I'm going to do a whole show on Dr. Namam and have her friends on to tell her whole story, because I don't know a lot about her. She was very discreet in so many ways. For example, I'll just say this. To me, this story says everything you need to know about her. I do not know her ethnicity or her religion, I can promise you. When she would be with somebody who is a hardline Muslim, she would say she's Jewish. When she would be in the presence of a Jewish person, she would say she's Muslim. When she was with Yazidi, she would say she's Kurds. When she was with Kurds, she would say she's Yazidi. Whatever you were, she'd say you were the group she thought you didn't like. Unbelievable. I never saw anything like it. And by the way, she would say this, like, you know, not in coffee shops in New York. I mean, out there. She was always standing with the other. And even if you were the other, she would wonder who you were othering. And she'd stand with them in front of you. In fact, she told me the story. She saved her, spent her whole year working in Sweden. She saved up all her money to buy an ambulance. And she brought this ambulance to an IDB internally displaced persons camp. And she had this ambulance there. And, well, some of her discoveries of some things that were going on in the camps upset some people. She made public some things that were going on in this camp that shouldn't have been going on. Well, those folks set her ambulance on fire. And so I said to her, you know, Rene Girard, the Catholic anthropologist, said, when you're in solidarity with the vulnerable, you become as vulnerable as they are. And she, without flinching, this is like hours after her ambulance was set on fire, that she worked a year to buy. She said, yeah, and just because we're in solidarity with the vulnerable doesn't mean we have the right to expect them to be in solidarity with us. That was her response just hours after finding out. And actually, they tried to hurt her personally, physically. And her response was, yeah, you know, we're serving them, but we don't have any right to expect anything in return for them. What a beautiful woman. And I'm going to put a picture of her in the show notes with her Eric Metaxas cup. All right. This was the most rambling conclusion ever. I think it's just because, it's been a rough day. So go to the Vulnerable People Project's website, thegreatcampaign.org, become a monthly donor, and get my book with the great John Smirak, The Race to Save Our Century. All right, until next time, The Jason Jones Show.
This has been The Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.